Audi.
Sergeant and Mrs. Smith, you are going to love this house.
Is that a tub in the kitchen?
There's no field manual for finding the right home. But when you do, USAA Homeowners Insurance can help protect it the right way. Restrictions apply.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the Big Travel Podcast. I'm Lisa Francesca-Nand. I've got a new venture starting, and actually it's something that many people have said to me, what took you so long to do this? I'm actually starting my own travel agency. It makes absolute sense to be doing all this travel and then coming back and sharing it with people. It makes absolute sense to also be able to offer them the holidays that I take, and indeed other ones, and book them. So it's called LFN Travels, and I'm just working on a logo, and it should be ready to launch very soon. So two opportunities here for you. One, please let us book your holidays if you're going anywhere, whether that's in the UK or beyond. We can book package trips, we can book hotels, we can also book concert tickets, sporting events, and it's all ABTA backed with a very long-standing company doing the back office work. So please let us book your holidays. Just get in touch with me on social media. Also, there's a new email address, which is lfntravels@gmail.com, but you can just get in touch with me on social media as well. I've got a little team in place ready to help me book your travels. And talking about the team, this opportunity also includes the option for you to join us too, where you can set up as an independent travel agent and book your own holidays if you wish, and also book holidays for other people and earn plenty of residual income. It's a really good model, and not many people realize that when you're booking things through, say, booking.com and Expedia online, you're already paying commission. There's no getting away from it unless you're a travel agent. So you might as well give it to someone you know, a small business like mine, or one of the people who are going to help me. And you might as well set up as a small business yourself and do it yourself if you're traveling lots. So two things to think about there. I'm going to be officially launching in the next few weeks, and I can't wait to share it with you. I'm really excited, and I can't believe it's actually taken me so long to do it. Now, on to today's guest, who is amazing. You're going to love her. Barbara Buchek spent 10 years in the management team at the Port of Dover, but over 2 years ago moved continents to establish Saudi's new cruise scene with Cruise Saudi. On this episode, we talk about the special relationship the UK have with Dover, the emotional tug of those white cliffs, how travelling by sea gives you a different perspective on a land, feeling like she's living through history, witnessing the cultural changes in Saudi, climbing to Everest Base Camp, jogging through a Taiwanese forest, the unbeatable feeling of running the London Marathon, and much more. Barbara Buchek is on the Big Travel Podcast.
Right, it's wonderful to speak to you. My goodness. And the thing is, with a lot of my guests, there's a lot of information out there about them and their travels. But I couldn't find that much information about you and your personal travels out there. And I guess because you've had this incredibly successful corporate career, it's not necessarily something that you talk about, your personal travels, which is what we do talk about on the podcast. So I detect an accent, first of all. Let's start with that.
Sorry, understand my accent?
Yes.
Okay, so it's a very mixed accent, I guess. I'm Polish, raised and born in Poland. Then randomly, my private life when I was a child took me to all sorts of summer schools in England, where I probably have picked up a little bit of a British accent, then followed through to Kentucky for high school, where I picked up a very Southern American accent randomly. Then got chipped away a little bit when I went back to Poland and then England for my undergrad and then my master's degree also in England. And then quite a lot of my corporate life in England for 16 years and now in Saudi. So, I guess when I sometimes speak to the American colleagues or friends, I'll revert back to the American twang a little bit, but I will hopefully not do that on this podcast. I'll try to retain my identity as a mixed bag.
I love it. It must really surprise Americans when you suddenly come out with a Kentucky accent. I grew up in the south of Spain where my parents moved there, even though I'm not Spanish. And apparently when I go to other places, the people notice that I've actually got quite an Andalusian accent rather than some nice sort of, you know, well-spoken Madrid accent. I actually sound like a bit of a, you know, an Andalusian, which is not quite the same. So that must surprise some people when you're in the States and you come out with a Kentucky accent.
I think yours is probably even more surprising than mine. Mine is a very fake and put on one. So I think it's, you're probably in a better place than I am.
So tell me about moving to Kentucky as a child. That's fascinating. Why? What did that happen? What were your family doing?
It wasn't a family. I moved when I was 15 and I went for one of those exchange programs where you go and live with the family and you just attend the high school, which is what I did. And I have to say it was probably one of those more character building exercises in my life. And I think that kind of sets you out for life going forward, where if you're on your own at that age and you move and you kind of are in a position of you either sink or swim, so you either get on with it or you are terribly missing your family, it's a choice that you actually have to ultimately make. And I remember that. I remember, it's a funny story, really. I remember I got there. It was a completely different type of living that I would have had in Poland. And I found myself on this prairie on the corn farm in Kentucky, lying on my waterbed, terribly missing my family. And then I remember lying there thinking, no, I really, really need to just get on with it. And I remember I got up and that was a conscious decision that I made to enjoy it. And I did thoroughly enjoy my experience. And it, as I said earlier, it was character building. And it kind of sets you out later on to just be able to find the best in the situations that you are in and enjoy the cultural differences. And I think this is what I took forward in my life, of being able to go to places and really loving the experience where I am at that particular time in life.
What was the culture? How was the cultural difference for you, a girl from Poland, to suddenly end up living in Kentucky?
Well, first of all, I was completely far away from my family that I grew up with and all my friends. And so it was one of those typical, you know, movie-like experiences when you enter a new American high school and you're completely on your own and you need to find out whether they're the mean girls and who are the cool kids and which group you're going to fall into, but also very different way of thinking. I'm a 1980s child, so back then in Poland, especially when we were thinking about career at the age of 15, 16, you're thinking about this reasonable career path and what will be your best economic situation. So you were taught very much to choose your career based on that, whereas then you get thrown into America and it was a very different way of thinking of, you know, I'm going to do whatever I love doing and choosing your career and your educational path based on that. So this was a slightly different way of thinking. And I loved, what I absolutely loved about the Americans is of how proud they were of their country, culture, their nation and their identity, which is very similar to Saudis. So it's a very similar national pride identity that I really experienced very much in Saudi and in America. And Poland is similar, but it was just slightly different, slightly more grandeur tale in America at that time when I was a kid.
What was your first day like when you were walking? Did you have that sort of, I'm walking down the corridor in an American high school with the lockers on either side, you know, holding your books, people bumping into you in the corridor? Was it like that?
It was exactly that. It was, you know, the experience of the yellow bus, which obviously in Poland at that time we didn't have. And the school that I attended, which was, let me just refresh my, I think it was called Robertson High County, something like that. And it was a school that basically got all the kids from around nearby small towns and villages. So it was a very mixed school, everybody arriving at the same time. They could cool kids in their cars. So very much, you probably remember the Beverly Hills sitcom or a show at that time. I know people probably from Beverly Hills will say that Kentucky is very different. I mean, the perception was very much similar at that time. And I have to say, the the experience was great. I learned a lot. The school curriculum was very different than the ones we would have followed in Poland. So I loved, and I still firmly believe in it to this day, that when you throw yourself into something completely different and in the area that is so tremendously different to your day to day, it is the most character building, the most, brain building exercise, I guess. I don't know how to call it, but it really helps you grow as a person.
Did you stay in touch with the family? What were they like?
I did to some extent. For a long period of time, I still talk to some people that I have met back then. The family was very different. They were from a family of farmers. I come from a family, but my mother is a doctor, my father is an engineer. My father was into coal mine. They were very much from a farming background. Very different than my family. It was a very mixed family. All the Bolton stepsons, stepdaughters, and that was obviously not what I had back home. But I'm still in touch with them, and it was it's still very much part of my life and part of my identity, I guess.
So you went back to Poland after that, and then at some point you found yourself spending 10 years in the port of Dover, which is not actually, well, you might have been literally in the port of Dover, but at the port of Dover, as in, you know, a workplace, and worked your way up to an incredibly high position there. What happened in the intervening period from leaving school in Poland and then, you know, getting that very interesting job?
So again, a very random road. I'm not your linear career or linear life path kind of person. I'm one of those people that I take opportunities as they come rather than planning, which is probably against all the textbooks in your life that you would need in terms of management. When I got back to Poland, I finished my high school. I started my degree, which was linked to business and politics, did an Erasmus program courtesy of European Union in the University of Surrey in England. And after that, after the undergrad degree in Poland, I decided that I have to go to Germany randomly and live in Germany because I didn't feel that I picked up my German language well enough at university. So I decided the only way for me to learn is actually physically being there. Then I spent randomly again a month in Denmark before I decided to go back to Surrey to do my master's degree. And I did that at Surrey University in the south of England, and then started... my first job was really temping at the Southeast England Development Agency, which was a governmental body, and the chief executive of the Port of Dover was one of the board members. And one time he asked me to come and talk to him about the opportunity of joining the port, and it was at that time an opportunity to work with him directly on the privatization of the port. And I thought, that's a very interesting experience. Most of my university colleagues from Surrey went to London, and I went completely the opposite direction to Dover. And I think that was one of the best decisions that I had. I have to say, I cut my teeth on all the experiences that I had at the Port of Dover. Great asset. Although it may come across as a small business, it's a very important business for the UK economy. So the work that we did, for those who are not aware, from the listeners who are not aware, Port of Dover is a small business, small in terms of footprint port, but a very important and that carries huge amount of goods that arrive UK, and it's one of the main connections between Port of Dover and the Eurotunnel between mainland Europe and UK. So most of the goods that UK is trading with Europe go through the Port of Dover, and it's still one of the main trading partners for the UK. So 10,000 trucks a day going through a very small footprint, super busy, and also in comparison to quite a lot of other ports, it's one of the entities that does everything hands on, and we run that port very much hands on with most of the elements of operation and the business being still within the Port of Dover control itself. And I did, for my 10 years at the Port of Dover, I did anything from communications to operations, business development, corporate development, looking through asset development. One of the most transformations period at the Port of Dover were at the time when I was there. So I was very lucky to work with the people. And during the time that was so important, obviously at the end of it was also Brexit. So super, super interesting challenges that we went through.
What's it? I mean, I do talk about the Port of Dover a lot on TV and radio, you know, because it's a huge part, like you said, a small business, but a huge part of our link to the rest of the world, to the continent. And of course, I'm often talking about the Brexit issues, you know, the delays since every passport needs to be, you know, double checked and everything like that. You know, it just obviously builds up, even if you're checking somebody for an extra 30 seconds, you know, that builds up for a lot of people. I also used to talk about Operation Stack quite a lot when I was doing, was that you in charge of that? So I was, when I did my journalism training, I was a traffic and travel reporter, not travel that I do now, but traffic and travel, you know, on the M20, we've got traffic backed up or whatever it was. So I speak about this a lot, but actually, if I confess, the last time I went through Dover was like 10 years ago. I'd love to go again. I love ferry travel. My question, I've got to flip it back to you now. A couple of questions, actually. Dover is an unusual place, in the UK. You know, Kent itself, I was living in Southeast London for a long, long time. Kent itself, obviously, is the gateway, to Europe and, you know, vice versa as well. But there's a lot of poverty in areas of Kent. There's also a lot of money in areas of Kent. It's an area that has a huge juxtaposition of life. What was it like for you, you know, living there and spending so much time there?
You're spot on, Lisa. It's a very interesting county, very interesting port, very interesting business that a lot of people don't appreciate how integrated it is within the local community as well as a business. Port of Dover has been there for 400 years. So a lot of local community also feels very emotionally connected to the Port of Dover itself, which is a blessing to some extent and also to some extent a curse, because people have quite a lot of opinions on what the Port of Dover should be like, how it should be operated, what it should do going forward. A big part of my heart still remains at that particular port. As I said earlier, I've learned a lot there. But you're absolutely right. You wouldn't appreciate how diverse Kent is, known by everybody as the Garden of England. Absolutely, quite a lot of what we would call posh areas with a lot of old money, horse riding, and one of the best still in existence grammar schools in England, juxtaposed to the area that really are deprived. And I remember once being on the train, taking a train to London for some business meeting, sitting with a lady who was going for a training to London and telling me about. She was in one of the schools in one of the deprived areas, and she was telling me about the issues that she had, that, you know, they still have in this day and age, they have children coming to school, for example, without uniforms or without lunchboxes. And a lot of people don't appreciate how those areas are affected and continue to be, especially in the current economic climate that we all find ourselves in. For me personally, the experience of work of living in Kent was great. I can't say anything negative. I love the area. I love how green it is. I love London itself. London is also quite firmly wedged in my heart. However, Kent is very British, and I like that about Kent.
What about your experience as a woman in what I imagine? I'm just imagining this, actually. I haven't done the stats work, but I imagine it's quite the maritime industry is quite a male dominated industry.
It is, and it has been when I first joined. I joined Port of Dover in 2010. However, Dover as a port was a very interesting place where I have not felt the diversity issue at all as an issue. It was always, since I've been there, a place where I've never personally felt that for the fact that I'm a woman or that people may have different preferences in life would have been disadvantaged. It was, you just simply, if you were good at your job, you moved ahead, and likewise if you weren't, you wouldn't. And it was we looked into the pay gap issue as you would, because that was a very topical matter in England. I was at some point also involved through my Dover career in UK, the initiative set up by former shipping minister Nusrat Ghani on trying to further the matter of diversity in maritime. I was working there with the team. So yes, it is a male-dominated industry. It's moving miles ahead at the moment. Still quite a lot of things to work through. However, I personally never had an issue, and certainly not in Dover.
And have you been able to, when you were there, were you able to travel a lot, or were you literally just hopping on a ferry to Calais every now and then?
You know, I actually traveled a lot, because probably unbeknownst to quite a lot of people, Dover is a lot more about, there's a lot more to Dover than just ferries. Obviously 75% at that time when I was there, apologies to my Port of Dover former team if I get my stats incorrectly now, but at that time was with the ferry business. However, I also used to cover it. I was responsible for cruise business and the cargo business. And obviously cruise business is all over the world, and cargo business is the one that we were involved in when I was there was very much either European or even South American. So I had an opportunity to cover quite a lot of ground. I was also involved in the project randomly with the former chief executive of developing consultancy. So we also covered Asia, Taiwan and so on. And we won some projects there when I was at the board. So I have had an opportunity to travel a lot. And I always used to attach a few days here and there for myself to have a look at the destination. Absolutely loved it. And Taiwan is a very interesting place to go and visit as well.
I was going to pick up on Taiwan. I don't think we've ever really spoken about Taiwan on this podcast. I'm sure I've had people that have been on because I've had some very well traveled people on, but tell me about your experience in Taiwan.
I loved it. I think it was so people, first of all, very, very welcoming, beautiful scenery in some places, an interesting area in terms of topography, because you have the Long Island. So as you travel through the island, you see different areas, and the ports that I have visited allowed me to see those different areas, because there's Taiwan, Hualien, Taipei, Kaohsiung, and Keelung. Those are the ports that I mainly visited, and every single one of them presented something different to me. I'm a runner as well, so I quite often visit places through my running. And I remember I signed up for this random run as part of my time in Taiwan with the Harriers. That's one of the groups that always runs around the world. And I found myself running through this really deep forests with rivers and some really old, beautiful villages. It's a great place. It's very versatile. The culture is super interesting. The museums are very culturally detailed and connected, so I recommend for everybody to visit.
And did you go there by ship, or did you fly? And then
I flew. I know that they are developing their cruise industry and they have been quite successful over the past few years. However, from England I flew with Eva Air mainly.
Oh, my favorite airline. Arriving by ship somewhere, obviously didn't fly, you flew that time, but arriving by ship somewhere is a whole other experience, isn't it? And what you mentioned there, you know, even when you're coming out of Dover, when you see those white cliffs, it can be quite emotional. And when you're arriving in another place, it's a view that you don't necessarily get, for a lot of people. What has been the best arrival by ship? What do you think that's meant a lot to you? You know, where have you been? And arrived.
No, you know what? I'll say Port of Dover, but I will say this because of the White Cliffs. So I know that there are some really beautiful areas, but I think Dover and there's so much history with the cliffs, and so much, again, especially if you're close and familiar with the culture, you understand how culturally, historically that those particular cliffs are, and how very much wedged they are in quite a lot of songs, with Vera Lynn singing about the birds over the White Cliffs of Dover. So for me, it will always be Dover. However, I have to say, I have a wonderful experience now with looking into the Red Sea and exploring the Red Sea in Saudi.
And you're talking to us from Saudi today. Are you in Saudi?
I am in Saudi. I'm in Jeddah. I'm looking from my window. I'm looking at the beautiful Red Sea. And I have to say, it's an experience in its own right at the moment. And it's so unexplored and it's so beautiful, especially in those, so some of those areas where you're not necessarily coming into the, commercial port, when you're looking into the areas of off the beaten track, and those new destinations that we're developing, it's a spectacular experience as well.
So how long have you been with Cruise Saudi?
I have been in Saudi now for 2.5 years. And that's my time in Saudi. I came here specifically to work at Cruise Saudi. And I arrived in October 2021, I think, if I get my time correct.
And what was that like? I mean, if somebody came to me, that's quite a big deal, isn't it? Somebody approaching you and I don't know if you applied for the job or were headhunted and actually came to you and said, you know, come and work in Saudi Arabia. I mean, that's quite a, how did that come about?
So I was approached by one of the colleagues that I knew from the industry who was here with us at Cruise Saudi. And as I said to you earlier, Lisa, I'm one of those people that I take opportunities as they come. I'm a firm believer that you say yes to the opportunity, obviously with moderation. But Saudi for me, I know it may sound weird for some people, but it was no brainer. I don't think you very often get an opportunity in life to work on something that is so new, so undiscovered, so special. I had different employment opportunities on the way, and for me, Saudi is the place to be at the moment. It's the Vision 2030 is so interesting. It is being part of history.
Yeah, to be in a country that is changing so quickly. Is that how you feel?
I see it with my own eyes.
What is it like for you there now?
So I have been in Jeddah. Quite a lot of areas in Saudi are different. Jeddah is always the one that is always explained to me for a person that hasn't been here for that long as a place that has always been open and in comparison to some other areas because of being the coastal city, the gateway to Mecca. It already had an influx of quite a lot of foreigners and visitors in comparison to some other areas. However, even in Jeddah, you see the change. I remember I told you a story. I was running a marathon once, and we were running through the streets of Jeddah, and a Spanish fellow runner who I have not known approached me, and whilst we were running, obviously with our disrupted breath, said, do you feel like you're part of the change, part of history? And I said to him, absolutely, I do, because you see all those people lining the streets and the young girls and the young men watching us, and it was great. The change, I can't even describe it, because it's all very positive. But what I like about Saudi and the change in Saudi is it's a positive change, but with a deep connection to the past and the history and the culture. And I like that about Saudi. The change that is happening is in the Saudi way, and it's very authentic, and the authenticity remains preserved. And I like that about Saudi, and I hope that it will continue as well.
What's the most beautiful view you've encountered in Saudi?
Oh my God. You know what? I can't even tell you. I don't know where we begin. It's such a versatile place. I travel a lot, privately and through work, to areas where you either wouldn't reach by cruise because it's the business that I work for, but also that you wouldn't. I would say, like everybody else would these days, Alula is just something so special. It's such a special place. So when you arrive in Alula, if you have not seen any previous pictures, it really takes your breath away. And I've been to Alula now at least 8 times, and it does that to me every time I go there because of the colors, because of the rock formation. It's just something that is out of this world. Even if you don't visit Hegra, Alula itself, the area is most wonderful. But when you go to Asir region, which is maybe not yet that popular, you see not only the mountainous area of Saudi, but you see also the culture aspects with the flower men and the local people still very much within those attires. And it's just something that you don't see very often these days. And then I don't think you can forget about the Red Sea. There is an area, either you can talk either about Farazan or the Al Waj area. I think one of the places that really took my breath away was Al Waj from the sea perspective. I mean, the place itself is really nice, but the sea is so pristine. The Red Sea islands all over the Red Sea. It's something that we really need to work very carefully to preserve going forward, because you don't see that in many places in the world anymore.
And we don't automatically think of Saudi as a cruise holiday destination.
Not yet, but actually, we have been so successful in the last 3 years that we have been developing this particular industry in here that we have to pat ourselves on the back a little bit. We had 11 different cruise lines, 300,000 passengers already visiting Saudi. And we have opened up quite a lot of new regions. And what I love about the people of Saudi, that they are so excited and they are so welcoming when it comes to people visiting Saudi, whether it's by cruise or any other means of arrival. The Saudi half hour is next to none. This is the generosity in hospitality. And I have experienced it myself, and our guests experience it. And as we go forward with the development plans that we have, which are quite ambitious, 10 different destinations by 2030, we will be able to offer cruise lines really meaningful itineraries. And the Red Sea itself, together with Egypt, with Jordan, offers so much for the cruise that when you think about how busy the Mediterranean Sea is, Saudi and the Red Sea will become definitely the alternative, especially when it comes to seasonality. We are completely complementary to the Mediterranean season. So I'm very confident that this is the area that is that will be the next big hit, or is already the next big hit on the cruise itinerary planners' minds.
So where would, because cruises often go to other countries, that's the whole point, isn't it? And I've never been on a cruise, actually. I'd love to try a cruise. And one, I know cruising has huge fans. And, one of the things they talk about is you go and unpack on a ship and then you see four or five different cities or countries, cities and countries sometimes, depending where you go. And you don't have to, you know, you're being taken to them, which is wonderful. You're not, you know, flying, unpacking and doing that sort of thing. Where would if someone was going on a cruise that took in Saudi, where else would that cruise be going?
Oh, let's assume that you're joining our soon to be launched Aroya in Jeddah, which will be our own cruise lines that we will welcome to our family in not too distant future. Ideally, you would start in Jeddah. That will be your home port. We would ideally want you to come at least a day before for your pre and post, so we could show you around the Al Balad, which is one of the UNESCO heritage sites. Wonderful old town of Jeddah, loads of cultural experiences that you can have. You board your ship in our port, and we would take you, hopefully the next stop would be to Yanbu, which is a place where we normally would take guests from Yanbu to Medina, or another area in Yanbu. It's also a Lawrence of Arabia town known for Lawrence of Arabia house and his time there. We would at some point want to fly you to Alula, because at this stage we are only in the process of working on developing one of our gateways for Alula. So at this moment in time we would most likely fly you in either as pre and post. But then you would go to Jordan, Aqaba. So again, it's one of those itineraries that you can build. Alula, for example, is one of those sites that Nebatin has developed. You've got Hegra there. So the natural next stop will be going to Jordan and visiting Petra through Aqaba. Then most likely you would have ports in Egypt that have so much to offer when it comes to destinations for the guests. Ideally combine it with the private island that we're developing and we're hopefully be launching in not too distant future, where you would be able to relax and take your beach break, and maybe a day at sea for you to enjoy the ship. So that's the idea itinerary. Going forward in the future, we're also will be working on developing the south side of the Red Sea, where you would we would ideally like to take guests to Jizan, which is the gateway for a sea region. There's so many things to visit in Saudi, and in the, again, going forward, we will also be adding the northern part of Saudi with Neom ports that Neom is developing, and Sindala Island there as well. Not forgetting the Red Sea global developments that are going on at the moment, but that's for more luxury part of the leisure crafts and yachting fraternity. So tons to do in the Red Sea, tons to do in on the Saudi coast of the Red Sea. If you were to join the ship on the Arabian Gulf, from Saudi perspective, we would take you to Dammam. It's a ready-made cruise destination with quite a lot of opportunities to visit Bahrain, Saudi, Qatar, Abu Dhabi. So a lot of stops that you can cover on that particular side of the Red Sea. So a lot to offer and a lot to see.
Well, it sounds really amazing. I'd absolutely, you know, love to try that out. And I think it must be really interesting for you to be at the forefront of a destination that is undergoing so much, with an eye to history and keeping the good bits, but undergoing such cultural and change and developing a tourism, developing it as a destination for tourism from not necessarily scratch, but, you know, from pretty early in the process. Must be really interesting for you.
I don't think we shy away from saying from scratch, because it is developing it from scratch. Obviously, we're not doing it ourselves as Cruise Saudi. There is Saudi Tourism Authority and a lot of entities that we're working with. And it is really a very collaborative work, and very much developing not just the destination, but also the entire ecosystem of all the relevant parties that need to contribute in the future to really making the guests' experience seamless. Saudi obviously has been very familiar with the type of tourism that it will say, the religious and tourism. But the leisure tourism is something that is very new, and it is being redefined in Saudi at the moment, in various different guises. But I have to say, for those who are contemplating visiting Saudi, Saudi really truly has everything to offer. Not from, I know I spoke a lot about the culture aspects, but there's so many recreational opportunities in Saudi. The entertainment at the moment is really, really booming. I genuinely have a major FOMO every time I leave Saudi. For those who don't know, fear of missing out. Maybe it's a new term. I don't know. I'm showing my age here. Whenever I get on the flight or on the ship to leave Saudi, I do think, my goodness, what am I going to be missing out on this particular weekend? Because there's so much happening. From a sports perspective, a lot of initiatives currently being developed, not only from golfing perspective, but also tennis recently, boxing, not forgetting, obviously, in Jeddah, Formula One and Formula E, all sorts of activities. But obviously, the concerts were driven and pushed forward and developed by the Middle Beasts, who are doing a fantastic work, all the way to recently announcements about the Opera and all the fantastic concerts that are in Maraya, that's a concert hall in Alula itself. A lot happening, and it's I said that earlier. It is really a time to be in Saudi at the moment.
What's it like being a woman in Saudi? You know, because we hear all these. I know women now are allowed for the last 5 or 6 years to drive. You know, but you know, I do hear people talk about a certain amount of repression still. And obviously there are still human rights issues in terms of LGBT travelers. And you know, the changes are happening, but then they're not necessarily, I get the impression that they're not necessarily there yet.
So I can only talk about my own experience. And I think this is, and I always caveat that, because I always feel that I'm a bit fraught if I talk on behalf of someone else, and I can't do that. But as a woman in Saudi, I've been here for the past 2.5 years, I had only positive experience. and I can only again say that from my perspective. In our company itself, we have over 30% of women, which even if you compare it to the standards of some of the European companies when it comes to shipping, is quite a big number already. And you are not, actually, a lot of the times you're, from my perspective, what I have seen, you're celebrated as a woman, in Saudi. And I truly appreciate that. And especially the notion of the mother in Saudi is so tremendously important. But I have to tell you, you're absolutely also right. This is the matter that is so much of interest to a lot of people that every time I travel back to Europe or to anywhere else in the world, that is the question that I always get asked. And a lot of the time, with our Western ideas about Saudi, a lot of people think that I am pulling their leg when I say that I have a wonderful experience, but I truly do. And I can only talk about that, that I have been welcomed. Even from my working perspective, I work in a very male-dominated industry. I do work in the ports a lot that were previously in Saudi and anywhere else in the world really male-dominated. I never had an issue. I speak to people of all sorts of ranks and levels, and I have only had respect so far and really good collaboration. I had not had a single bad experience. I'm not saying that it is everybody's experience, but as I said earlier, that is what I can only refer to. I always feel a little bit fraught if people tell me, well, for example, ask me, how is it to be a Saudi woman? I don't know. I'm not a Saudi woman. But as a guest in this country, I've been welcomed. I have to say, I love my Saudi female colleagues. They're one of the strongest women I got to know. Very versatile, greatly educated, a lot of them in the engineering background, which again, sometimes at the moment in Europe, it's a bit, the STEM agenda is becoming a little bit, forgotten. But in here, it's very much with a high profile. So that is my experience. And that's what I can tell you about. And I can tell you, if you came here, you would have the half hour from everybody as a guest and as a female guest.
So where else have you traveled that I need to know about? What's been your travel CV in that sense?
In Saudi?
In elsewhere in the rest of the world.
I like to, I'm one of those, I don't know whether the word is intrepid. Is that the correct word?
Yeah, intrepid, yeah.
The travelers, I like to go to places where I can really unwind. I have a busy working life. And a busy private life. So I like, if I travel on my own, I like to go to somewhere where, I can really get my mind off of everything that is going on, preferably to the mountains, actually. So one of my best experiences is always, is always in the mountains, and being active. I think one of my best, trips was, doing, the Kathmandu and traveling to Nepal and visiting base camp in Everest, and it was a great experience, and it's just such a beautiful place. And I tell you what happened there when I did the trek. I did a little bit off season, and the best thing that could have happened to me did. My phone and my camera died because of the freezing temperatures, which basically meant that I was left to just enjoying the views, which is such a blessing. And I knew that there were tons of people around, they were taking pictures, and I just absolutely loved the experience and the people there. And it's so breathtaking and beautiful. So that would be, if you were to put anything on your list to do, that would be the one that I would do if I were you. It actually is not that, physically straining, people may say. There are a lot of programs developed at the moment that will allow all sorts of levels of physical capability to enjoy this particular trek. So I think that would be what I would recommend. And another place that I absolutely love is Croatia. I think it's just such a beautiful place to experience from the sea.
I haven't been to a base camp, but I have been to Croatia, so I can relate to that. That moment when you arrived at base camp, how long had you been trekking, climbing, walking for, and what did it feel like? How did it look like? Describe that moment to me.
So the funny enough, the base camp itself, obviously you get there. You know, you've achieved something. You've been walking. I don't remember. I think it was something like 7 days, because then you have obviously less amount of days for your trek down, because you're almost running down. Obviously you have this notion of achievement, but for those who have not done it, there is always an opportunity to visit another small peak, either it's either to watch the sunset or the sunrise, that you can do after you have reached the base camp. I don't remember the name of it now, but you basically come back down and go back up in order to view the Everest and the base camp from that particular peak. My goodness, that was one of the most challenging experiences that I had. I don't know why stupidly I took my backpack that I still had with me. It wasn't a heavy backpack. It was probably less than 10 kilos, but every step due to altitude and the tiredness felt like literally climbing a massive mountain. It was just one step because of the altitude. But actually reaching that particular peak and turning around after this monumental effort that it was to get there, and turning around and seeing the beautiful, we did the sunset. So watching the beautiful golden sun shining onto the mountains around us, and just complete quietness, birds flying. It was spectacular. And that will forever remain in my mind.
You've had some, that what strikes me about you is, yes, an absolutely intrepid traveler. There's not many people I speak to that have been to Everest Base Camp that aren't actual explorers or mountain climbers, or, you know, they just, you know, you're just doing it as a hobby. You know, I have spoken to a lot of people who do it, but you see the world by sea, you see the world up high with your love of mountains, but also you mentioned running. And to me, that's another really great way to see a place. If I go somewhere, I like to go on foot or cycle, or I do like running as well to explore a new town or a new city, or even my own town and own city. What's the best travel related run you've been on?
Oh my goodness. It's not travel related, but the best run I've ever done is London Marathon. I have to tell you. I have to say that because as a person who I have been to London so many times, but having done London Marathon as a runner, and seeing the site on the day as a runner was the most spectacular experience. I have to say, it ruined the running marathons for me, because I don't think any other marathon will ever connect with me as much as London did, because I love the city and I love running. So I decided to abandon running marathons after I did London. And I loved it. But I have to say, everywhere I go, I love doing it. I did a run in Vancouver when I was in Canada, through the Stanley Park, and it was also so amazing. And everywhere you go, I don't have a particular one, because even in Croatia, I remember running. I mentioned previously the run in Taiwan. Last week I was in Miami for Sea Trade Cruise Convention, and I did my usual run on the South Beach, and it offers you the most spectacular sunsets, sunrises that you can ever think of. The only thing that is negative about running and sightseeing through running is that I have to say, at least from my side, it doesn't offer me the most glamorous photo opportunities because I'm not a very attractive runner.
I love that you said that about London, though. To me, the London Marathon, it just gives me chills. I used to live for many years. I lived at Mile One, just outside Greenwich Park. And to see people come through, I mean, I'd always be choking back tears, you know, just to see them, you know, knowing they've trained all this time, but also then watching them go around the Cutty Sark. I mean, you've still got quite a while left at that. Then watching them go over Tower Bridge and around St. Paul's, and just the monuments and the history and the emotion tied up with that and travel. You know, I love the fact that places can do that to us, and absolutely takes me back to what we were saying about the White Cliffs of Dover. You know, they're not just white cliffs sitting there. They're history and home and culture and an ancient monument. And they're the thing that people see when they're leaving their country, possibly to never come back and cross the world. And they're the things that people see when they're arriving, either back in their home country or to a totally new country. And I really love that about, you know, the things we've spoken about, is seeing seeing the world by running, seeing the world by sea, and also seeing the world up high, like you've done as well.
But I have to say, one of the runs that I forgot, you know what the coolest run is in Saudi? When you can run on the Formula One track.
Right.
So the Formula One track that is here developed in Jeddah during the week, it is sometimes used for runners. And there are some organized runs. And it's also so cool because you're running on this track that is so, it's so connected. But well, it's not connected. It's developed for the car racing, and then you're running it yourself. It's very cool.
That sounds amazing. Oh gosh, it's been lovely to talk to you. I'm going to ask you my last question now. And my last question is always about music. And I don't know if you're a big music listener when you run. But I always ask my guests to name one song that reminds them of a moment, a time and place of travel. Can you think of a song and a memory that's associated with it?
You know what? It's going to be a very weird song, but I'll say it. It's a Hotel California song. First of all, it's for some bizarre reason. I think I connect a lot of memories to this particular song all over. But I have a particular memory when I was traveling through to Key West from Miami with my friend, and that song came on. It was in my work. We were actually doing a work related trip, but with my very dear colleague Stephen, and it came up, and we both immediately shouted out, "This is our favorite song!" And it was because it's such an American tune. At least I associated it with an American tune. And being there on the QS, which is on the, we were actually crossing one of the bridges, and it was just such a fantastic moment and such a beautiful area as well of the world, that I probably would say this one. And every time that song comes on, I associate it with troublesome for some bizarre reason, even though it's not about trouble at all, but.
Well, it is, you know, California is also a place of trouble, but, that's wonderful. I love that. And I really love the song as well. Yeah. It's very evocative. Thank you so much, Barbara, for coming on the Big Travel Podcast. It's amazing. Really fascinating to speak to you.
Lisa, thank you so much. I do hope that I will see you in Saudi, and I do wish you, as you said, the return to Dover as well. It's a great place, but first you need to come to Saudi.
Yeah. It's consider it done. I'm there. Barbara, thank you so much for that. That was just a really, really fantastic insight into your life and what an interesting life you lead to. Thank you so much to everyone for listening. We'll be back very soon with more episodes.
Hi, my name is Kay Adams, and to be honest, I'm not so good with the aging process, so I enlisted my old chum, the filter-free Cara McKenzie, to advise.
Could you imagine being a porn star? The room would need to be really hot for me to strip off.
To be honest, she's not much help, but she is rather amusing. And along with some great guests, Joe Brand, Andy Oliver, Anton Dubek, Ruth Langsford, and Craig Revel Horwood, darling, we are learning how to be 60. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.